The Book Nook on WYSO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. And today we're going to go back to our archive of interviews and pull out one from 1999. Many things have changed over the years that I've been hosting this program. During the first 10 years that we had the Book Nook, I did all the interviews live, in studio, and probably 70% of the authors that I spoke to actually came out to Yellow Springs for the interviews. The rest of them were by telephone. Well, now, over the last 10 years that I've been doing the program, I would say that 99% of the authors I interview are on the telephone. A lot has changed over the years. There's a reason why a lot of authors don't come through the area anymore. Many reasons, actually. Some of them related to economic reasons. The economy, as you might recall, kind of went south back in 2008. Publishers stopped sending writers out on massive book tours. Back in the old days, we used to get a lot of writers who were coming through Dayton for their very first book. Now you hardly ever see that. And the economy has changed other aspects we won't get into, but that's the major reason that we don't get a lot of authors coming through in person anymore. Well, back in 1999, there was a miraculous appearance in our area by the best-known writer from Ireland, Maeve Binchy. I didn't realize how much of a miracle her appearance was until I went back and listened to this interview for the first time last week. She explained why she had never been on book tour in the United States and that this was her first book tour. And she only went to six cities, five of them major metropolitan areas like San Francisco, and then one other city, Dayton, Ohio. She came in with her husband, Gordon Snell, and he sat quietly during the interview. You'd never know that he was there. They had come from apparently a lovely lunch at the Wynn's Cafe. They had some glowing comments about how much they liked the wine list that day. And we really had a lovely chat. She spoke very quickly and was incredibly articulate. Let's listen now to Maeve Binchy from her only appearance. It's the Best of the Book Nook. Good afternoon, Miami Valley. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO, Public Radio for Southwest Ohio. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to have with me in the studio at this very moment, Maeve Binchy. How are you?
I couldn't be better, and thank you for inviting me, Vic.
Now, I heard a rumor that after all these books that you've written, this is the first time you've ever come to the United States on a book tour. Is that right?
Well, that's true. I've always wanted to, but first of all, you have to get, I suppose, well-known enough before people will send you around to different states to meet the people, because I always wanted to meet the readers in different parts of the country. But also, when my books did become successful, I had got very bad arthritis, and I used to have to walk on two sticks, and I would never have been able to make airports because I had to come through in wheelchairs, and it was exhausting for everybody. So a year and a half ago, I got a new hip, which, though I'm not exactly springing like a young gazelle from mountaintop to mountaintop, at least I have no pain. I can walk now. So I celebrated this by telling the American publishers that I could walk now, and if they wanted me to walk anywhere, I would. So they suggested six cities, of which Dayton, Ohio is one, and I'm delighted and proud to be here.
Well, we are truly blessed, because I know these other cities were fairly large cities, and then there's Dayton.
But I never thought of it that way. I thought of it as a place where there were going to be a lot of readers, where we were going to get a chance to see some of the countryside that I'd never seen before. I even got to see a bit of Kentucky, because we landed at Cincinnati Airport, so I'm numbering up my states that I have actually been through in my little notebook. And it all looks very nice, and I've only been here for just under 24 hours. And unfortunately, on these tours, you don't get an awful lot of time just to hang about and look at the place. But I know a little bit about Dayton. I mean, I know about the Wright brothers, and I know about some of the background. And I'm learning more from everybody that I meet.
Maeve, you've written a number of books. How many is it now?
Well, it's very hard. I'm never quite sure how many it is. Not because I'm forgetful. It's just that some of them are merged together. I think I like to call this number 14 in my head, because some of the books or short stories are published together as single volumes. But I call it 14 in order to make myself feel more important and having done more, achieved more in my lifetime, because I didn't really start writing until quite late on. I'm not exactly the Grandma Moses of writing, but I did start writing late, which I always think is a bit of an encouragement to other people when they want to start. There's no need to start at 21 full of angst. You could start writing at any age of your life.
It helps to have some experience under your belt, doesn't it?
Yes. In one way, I had a bad experience because I had a very good childhood. And as so many of my countrymen and women who have written such brilliant books at the moment, I'm thinking particularly of Frank McCourt and Angela's Ashes and of Nulo Fuelon and her very unhappy and confused childhood. They have produced magnificent works based on this because they were able to make sense of the unhappiness in their life. I am not saying this lightly, but I was very, very lucky to have had a very happy childhood. I was the eldest and most loved child of two people who loved each other. And we lived, if though not in richness, at least in comfort. And I always knew that I'd have enough to eat and that I'd be educated and looked after. And I lived in a country which was very safe in those days, and particularly the society I lived in, because my parents loved each other very much and I knew they wouldn't ever part. And so I had a very happy upbringing. Then I was a teacher and a journalist, and all these things helped me very much towards writing novels when I finally and rather belatedly got around to it.
And you knew Nulo at the Irish Times, where you were a journalist.
That's right. The Irish Times is a very good newspaper. I'm not at all able to get things. I'm a terrible, terrible technophobe when it comes to getting things on the internet, but the Irish Times has a great website. I have one myself, actually, where my people can look me up to. I've never been able to access it unless I'm with my 14-year-old nephew who'll do it for me. But the Irish Times is available to a lot of people in this country because they read a lot about Ireland on it. It's a very fine newspaper, and it has always encouraged people on it who could write. And lots of the members of staff have been poets or playwrights and or novelists or short story writers, as well as being doing our job as journalists. And I was on the Irish Times until very recently as a full-time staff member, and Nulo is still on it as a staff member. And so it is a paper where you meet a lot of other people with ambitions to write, and instead of people thinking you should go and do that on your own time, they encourage you to do it, which is good.
Maeve Binchy has joined us, and her new book is Tara Road. How did you get the idea for this one?
Well, I'm a great eavesdropper, and I'm always listening to people who are saying things. In fact, I'm a compulsive listener, and sometimes people wonder, because I talk so much, how do I have time to listen? But I do have time to listen. And I heard a woman in an airport once saying to another woman that she was divorced, and they were just two people who started to talk over a cup of coffee. And she said, "I didn't mean to be divorced. I thought we were quite happy, but he wasn't happy at all." "Isn't that extraordinary?" she said. "I thought we were totally content, and he said that we'd had nothing for years." So I got a great shock and alarm, which I'm sharing with your listeners now. Maybe lots of us are in those kind of relationships where we think we're happy, and we think, therefore, because we are, that the other partner is. And I wondered to myself, as I looked at this woman, she seemed a perfectly normal person. I wondered, was she to blame? Was she stupid that she didn't understand what was happening in her life? Or was she, in fact, a simple, honest, trustworthy person whose husband had decided he liked somebody else and pretended he still liked her? So that's the character where the character of Rhea Lynch came from. I wanted her to be, for the reader, somebody who'd be like your friend, your sister, somebody who was adorable and enthusiastic and enjoyable and tried to make a busy house. But perhaps you'd also want to smack her a bit from time to time, because she was perhaps a bit silly and she didn't realise that maybe her husband wanted a bit of quality time with her. And instead of just filling the house like it was Grand Central Station with a whole lot of people, she thought, because he had a quiet and lonely childhood, he'd like a very full house full of people. Maybe he just wanted a bit of peace, which is what he finally left her to go and get, that he went not to the high life and for people who were bopping the night away in nightclubs, but he went to a woman who was kind of quiet, silent and peaceful, and just where he could be himself and the centre of everything. So that was the first idea. And the second idea, because your books have to have a setting as well, the second idea I had was that Gordon and I went on a home exchange to Australia, and we lived in somebody's house. We never met this couple, and they lived in ours. Now, we talked our house up quite well, and we put an advertisement happened in Australia. Say we wanted to borrow a house for 2 months, and we'd give them our house. And their house was lovely, and our house suited them fine. So we talked to each other on the phone. We'd never met them. We never met them at all. And this was the most interesting thing. I felt I knew them intimately. It was a hugely intimate relationship. I was in their house, sleeping in their bed. I saw the towels they had. They had the nice good ones on top and the cheap ones underneath in the bathroom, just as I had done. And I knew them, and they paid their bills late. And I knew the postcards they were getting from friends. And I knew everything about them, much more than I'd know about people that I'd lived beside for 20 years on a road. I knew all their secrets. And I felt actually rather protective about them. I felt I'd like them. And when I did meet them, I liked them very much. In fact, sadly, the man died, so I had lunch with this woman. And we had a big long lunch in Australia last November. And she and I talked for 3.5 hours. And the waiter, when he was finally giving us the bill and finally getting rid of us, he said, "It's lovely to see old friends talking." And we said, "We've hardly ever met before." But because we'd lived in each other's houses, we knew everything about each other. So I thought that was a way to set the story. And it's the first time I've ever written a book about America. So when Ria has this awfully bad news that her husband is leaving, she wants to go somewhere to get her head together. And I chose for her the United States of America. And the reason I chose that, I'm not just saying this now because we're in America, I'm trying to say the right thing. But very often when I've been down, or I need to be exhilarated, or I need to be energized, I come to America, because I find there's something, I don't quite know whether it's in the drinking water or on the sidewalks or in the air, but I feel more energy here in America. And I also admire the way everybody in America has a sense of hope. They don't feel, because they're born into one situation or they have landed in that situation, that they must stay there. There's much more get up and go. It's part of the pioneering spirit that made this country the way it was. The people just didn't say, "Well, this is nice here on the East Coast, let's stay here." They pushed west and decided to see the whole country. And I think this is something that would have been good for Ria, this character, to come to America. And so what I did was I made it slightly different than you'd expect. I didn't put her into sort of downtown Manhattan and the terrible noise and all the rest of it. And I didn't put Marilyn, an American woman who had a similar but different tragedy in her life. She had a pain and an agony, which was not just a broken marriage, but something else. So I didn't give Marilyn the sort of Irish country cottage with somebody doing leprechaun duty outside and people playing the harp. I didn't give her that. And I put her instead into Ria's house, which was like, really was like a Piccadilly Circus or Grand Central Station, with everybody moving in and out the whole time. And I put Ria into not a huge, noisy urban situation, but into a very quiet university town where nobody came near her, because they all thought that since she was staying in the house of a recluse, she must be a recluse herself. But of course, all this gave her strength and made her cope. And the book is really about coping and finding strength from where you are.
You are listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, going back to 1999, for the only interview I ever had with Maeve Binchy. This is from her Wikipedia entry. Maeve Binchy Snell, born May 28, 1939. She died on July 30, 2012. Was known as Maeve Binchy. She was an Irish novelist, playwright, short story writer, columnist, and speaker, best known for her sympathetic and often humorous portrayal of small-town life in Ireland, her descriptive characters, her interest in human nature, and her often clever surprise endings. Her novels, which were translated into 37 languages, sold more than 40 million copies worldwide. And her death, at age 73, announced by Vincent Brown on Irish television late on July 30, 2012, was mourned as the death of Ireland's best-loved and most recognizable writer. We'll continue my 1999 conversation with the novelist Maeve Binchy right after this.
The Book Nook on WYSO is made possible by 5 local library systems, including the Clark County Public Library, the Wright Memorial Public Library, and the Dayton Metro Library. Together, these libraries support a culture of literacy and learning.
The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO today. I'm featuring an interview I recorded back in 1999 with Maeve Binchy. She actually came through Dayton on book tour. It was her only book tour that she ever made in the United States. As she explained in the first segment, she had some health concerns that caused her to not be able to travel very much. And so that had been taken care of and resolved, and that allowed her to come on this very short 6-city tour in 1999, five major cities, and Dayton, Ohio. And then, according to my research, she had more health problems the following year, which curtailed her book touring, making it even more miraculous that she came through Dayton, Ohio, and came out to Yellow Springs with her husband, Gordon Snell, and sat down for this interview. In fact, that's the same year that one of her books was chosen by Oprah's Book Club. You might recall what a big deal that used to be. She appeared in the U.S. market, featuring on the New York Times bestseller list, and that Oprah's thing really blew her books out of the bestseller list. She just sold and sold and sold after that in the U.S. She was recognized for what was known as her total absence of malice and her generosity to other writers. On World Book Day in 2000, there was a poll. In that poll, Maeve Binchy ranked number 3 with readers on World Book Day. She was ahead of writers like Jane Austen, Charles Dickens, and Stephen King. We'll continue with the best of the Book Nook now on WYSO.
Tara Road, is that a real road in Dublin?
No, it's not a real road. My father, being a lawyer, always said we must never put a real person or a real place into the books, because otherwise I'd be sued for libel, and that we'd be paying the litigation for the rest of our lives, and the house would go from over our heads. No, Tara being, it's funny, until I came to the United States, I'd forgotten the whole resonance and significance of Tara as the house of Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind. And you might think it's funny to have forgotten that, but the reason I'd forgotten it was because in Ireland, Tara was the ancient seat of the High Kings in Ireland. There's lots of places. Tara Street, there's a railway station called Tara. There's Tara Baths, or big swimming baths. There's Tara Mansions. There's Tara. There is no Tara Road. I checked it very carefully in all the gazetteers before I started to write the book. I use the name because it's kind of it signified Ireland to me. And of course, in Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind, that's exactly what Scarlett O'Hara's father would have called his house, because he was an Irishman who had come and made his money in the South, and then he would have called his house after an Irish place of historical significance. But it's not a real road, but it's real in this sense, and there's lots of roads like that, because Ireland has changed so much in the last few years. In my lifetime, it has changed dramatically, and we used to regard a house as a place you lived in, you know, a place with a roof and chimneys and windows and a door. Nowadays, it's an investment, and different streets are going up in value, and Ireland, which has become much more prosperous since its membership of the European Union, has a lot of young, ambitious people who want to make money, if you like, out of buying a house in the right area, doing it up, and then be able to sell it for a great deal of money. So when Ria and Danny Lynch are married and they live in this house in Tower Road, they would be very typical of a lot of young couples who have done the same thing.
And they bought the house at a time when the economy was depressed, and this was just an old Victorian eyesore to a lot of people. And over the course of time, with the Renaissance in Ireland, this area along Tara Road also experiences a gentrification and a revival. The property values go up. The house becomes a beautiful place. In fact, the house on Tara Road is really a character in the book on its own.
That's right. And you see, I've also tried when I'm writing a book, because I write almost as quickly as I talk, without much pause for punctuation, as I don't have much pause for breath. And when I was writing, I had a big piece of cardboard up beside me in front of the word processor, where I drew number 1, Tower Road, which was Colin Barry's restaurant. And then, as I mentioned everywhere else, I put them in. I drew the house each time. This is where Ria and Danny had bought, and this is where Ria's mother went to live in a little small cottage, and this is where Rosemary had her big penthouse flat, and this is where the old people's home was. This is the little road which turned into the corner where Gertie ran her laundromat. And sometimes it was so real to me that I used to think, when I came out of my own door, when I'd be working maybe 4 or 5 hours during the morning, come out of my own door, I'd wonder where all these houses were, because I'd been writing about them all morning, and it seemed more real than the actual street we lived in ourselves.
And Ria is so happy in her house on Tara Road, and as the case is in relationships sometimes, she's very happy and has almost a naivete about her husband's happiness and about the relationships around her. She's more aware of other people's relationships than she is of her own relationship. She's willing to go to great lengths to ignore things that might be wrong with her relationship, because she's just so happy to have her family, to have her home, to have her wonderful, handsome husband. And behind it all, there's all kinds of things going on.
But you see, I was once interviewed about this book by a man who was interviewing me for a program that went out on a plane, you know, one of those ones you listen to on a channel, excuse me, on a plane. And he said to me, you have now managed to unsettle everybody on the plane who's sitting flying happily from one destination to another by saying, I think that must be going on in lots of relationships. I really do. I think there's always, the French have a wonderful expression for it. The French have a good expression for almost everything, where they say that in every relationship, there is one who kisses and one who turns the cheek to be kissed. And of course, once you realize that, you start thinking, gosh, am I the one who kisses or am I the one who turns the cheek to be kissed? You would like to think we're all kissing equally, but very often in relationships, it's not so. And I'm sure you must have known, as I certainly have, many relationships where everybody outside thought these were the perfect couple and then they didn't seem to be perfect. But I think there are just as many inside where one partner is quite as happy as the other. And I don't know what, there's no solution. I mean, we couldn't be all constantly suspicious of our partners and have set a private detective on him or her every time they leave the house. But on the other hand, I suppose it's probably better, and I'm not a psychologist or an agony aunt, to sort of pause and assess the situation sometime and wonder, you know, is this the dream we had, or is there a way of examining it again and wondering if something could be there that isn't. I suppose that's what I'm trying to do, because it's very easy to solve everybody else's life. That's why I write fiction.
Maeve Binchy has joined us. Her new book is Tara Road. The book by Nuala, her autobiography, Are You Somebody, had situations where people in Ireland in real life were unfaithful. Men were unfaithful to their wives. There was no divorce legally in Ireland. And this is really a theme in your book as well. Was that situation with the inability to get a divorce something that caused a lot of this to go on?
Well, I don't know. I used to think at one stage when I was young and I heard about countries that have got divorces, you know, I mean, how awful for children in other countries. Then one day their father and mother might say goodbye and they'd be left between the two of them. But then as I grew up into my teens, I realised very many of the homes of my friends that I went into, they were cold, cold, loveless homes where people were tied together because the law would not allow them to separate and society wouldn't. And I do realise that hateful and painful as it is to come to the end of a relationship, and most of all painful on the children, it could be better and it could be more honest than pretending that everything was all right, particularly if one member of the family was having an illicit liaison with somebody else and nobody was talking about it. I think that is unhealthy for children because the children will eventually get to know about it. And I would prefer that if like any bargain or any contract, it could be ended legally and as hopefully as peacefully as possible. There aren't very many divorces that end very happily. I think that's a bit of a fairy tale where everybody smiles their way through the divorce court like they did through their marriage day. But I think of two evils, it's better to have it. So I'm trying to reflect that because this book is set in the late 1990s and there is divorce now on the statute book. It didn't pass the that we had a referendum on it in Ireland to vote, and it didn't pass all that by a huge majority. In fact, it was a very small majority. So, in other words, almost just under half of the people still would prefer there to be no divorce. But I feel a bit of a more liberal attitude, if you like, than some, that it would, it's not fair to have the religious beliefs of one group, which are particularly the Catholics, imposed on those who are not Catholics, and particularly since we want to try and be united with the north of Ireland, where mainly people are not Catholics. And we want to show that we don't want our church to be making laws for the state. For example, this does not happen at all in the United States. The church cannot make a law for a state. The church is separate from the state. People can have their own beliefs and their own beliefs. And if you don't want to have a divorce, or if you allow a civil divorce and don't have to have remarriage, nobody's forcing you. Nobody's got a gun to your head saying you must get married again. It just seems to reflect the present day. So when Rhea says in the book, when the American woman Marilyn says to you, are you divorced? She says, I don't know. I remember that line is quite accurate, really, because I don't know. We probably will be. I don't know. Because for years, people had what they called an Irish solution to an Irish problem, where they went to lawyers and they arranged that the property would be divided equally and then they lived with different partners. But it was never legal, and most people would like a marriage again, and if they were going to have children from the second union, they would much prefer to have those children given the name of that union. It's not easy. I'm not talking about it as if... Did you ever hear of anyone who says, I'd like to have a nice, good divorce this summer? Nobody's pro-divorce. No, we couldn't be pro-divorce. I'd love a nice divorce now. But I think, you know, if love ends and if truth and honesty and fidelity ends, then I think it has to be done legally.
The book is Tara Road. Maeve Binchy has joined us. I was reading the book, and you just kept drawing me further in. You have so many intriguing characters in the book, and then you do things. You have things that happen that really pique your curiosity, and you know you're going to have to read for a while to try to figure out what's going on, and you do this so masterfully. I was just amazed that the keyhole incident in particular was driving me crazy for the rest of the book.
Well, you're very good to say that, because obviously I'm thrilled that it held you. One of the things I like most of all is for people to believe that the characters are real. And I had a lovely incident recently where this woman said to me at a book signing, she said, I'd finished your book and the characters were so real. And I felt that I had the whole time. I said, I wanted to talk about something that has happened at work. And I thought I'd call Marilyn. She said, who's the character in the book? And I looked you up under V in my book, and I realised that she wasn't there because Marilyn Vine was not in my book. She was a fictitious character. And this woman said to me, I didn't know what to do with myself. Maybe sign myself into a psychiatric home. And I said, no. You did the kindest thing that anyone could have done. You came and told me about it because this is my reward for writing. My reward is being told that people thought the characters were real, because that's really good. That's really good if people, if she felt she wanted to telephone Marilyn and say something to her because she just finished the book, well, then I have really succeeded by making these people real. And I don't do much physical description of people. I'm not very interested in clothes myself, and so I never talk about what they wear. And I really sort of forget about how people look. When I know people myself, I forget how they look. I suppose, like everybody, you judge people momentarily on the first impression. But I forget how they look, so I never describe their looks. And at the end of the book, my editor always has to come back to me and put down beside each character's physical description, please, because I've forgotten to put. I know how they look in my mind, and so there's not long descriptions of people. So therefore, if people do feel they know them, it must be through their personalities and through their hopes and dreams. And what people call, I didn't realise, was called this sort of internal monologue. What I mainly think is what they were thinking, what they were worrying about. So I'm dead interested in what people are thinking and worrying about. I'm never bored by people. Every time I see somebody standing in the line waiting for to check in, I've been in the States now for quite a while, for nearly a month, and I've stood in line checking in for a lot of plane journeys. And I look at them all, the people standing there, and I wonder about them, where they're going. That man looks very tired, and I think perhaps on his going back home, he's going to tell his wife that business isn't good and he's been downsized. And that woman has arranged, she's going back to another city and she's going to have a date from a dating agency, and she's afraid the man is a serial killer. And I think all these things the whole time. So I'm very lucky that I have all these things. But I have no idea. If you ask me how they looked, I wouldn't be able to describe it. I just get a look in their face. And that's what I try to put into the characters. And if you remember them, then I think it's possibly because I've told you lots about what they were thinking, what they were hoping and dreaming.
And you're intrigued with people. And that really comes through as you follow characters, people that Rhea meets and becomes friends with very early in the book. You keep developing them, and one in particular is your vamp character.
Yes. Well, we won't give too much about that away, because you're a very kind man who has obviously read the book very carefully. And let me tell you, as many authors will tell you, that a lot of people have not read the book, but thank you for having done so. And yes, I think there are a lot of characters come into Rhea's life. There's her beautiful friend, Rosemary, who knows everything, who's a successful career woman and who dresses well and gets everything right. There's her friend, Polly, who used to run the dress hire agency, who was, I use the word mistress in an old-fashioned way, but she was the mistress of a big property developer, and knew her place, that she could go everywhere with him, but she must never go near his home area because his home was quite sacred. There was Gertie, who was a battered wife and who put up with her violent husband because she was timid of him. She thought she was the only one who could save him, and she thought if she left him that he would be absolutely lost. And there's Rhea's mother, who's barking mad, really, and who has her own views, is obsessed with film stars and has no views on anything else. And there's Rhea's sister, who's rather monetarily concerned. So there's a big cast of characters. It's almost like a Cecil B. DeMille. And when I wrote it first, there were even more characters. I had more characters all up and down at Tara Road. And I suppose you really would never finish the book. You wouldn't be able to carry it. We had to cut out an awful lot of them out. And I am very interested in people, and I'm very lucky in that. And it's not a question of saying it with any pride. I'm very sorry for people who just glance at other people and don't have a view about them and what they're going to do in their lives. And it does help me as a writer. Another thing that's helped me as a writer, too, of course, is being a journalist. Because being a journalist, you know that that you know that even if you have nothing to say on this program, it'll still come out because there's never been a blank air saying Vic had nothing to say, so the program is blank. And I know that in the Irish Times, even if I don't feel like writing, I'll write something. And so there's never a piece of white space saying this is may have been she's thoughts for yesterday. And that's a great help because a lot of other people who are starting to write think to themselves, the blank white page or the empty screen, what am I going to write? We're not afraid. People like you and I who have been used to this for a long time, we're not afraid of writing because we know it mightn't be great, but it's better to write it than to write nothing. And somebody once told me, it's the most useful piece of advice I ever have, you don't write any better when you write slowly. They didn't say you wrote brilliantly when you wrote quickly, but they said you don't write any better when you write slowly, so you might as well write quickly because it's over quicker and you get the story told. And so I believe that. And when I start the next book, I will remember that. I write that down for myself. And that'll keep me going. I finish a book possibly in about 7 or 8 months. I don't usually tell the publishers this because they think it takes a year. So I don't know why I'm telling you.
Well, I don't think they're listening right now. It's a secret.
It's a secret. Nobody's listening, isn't that right?
Well, I think there's one or two people out there listening.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, and today I am going back into our archive for an interview I did with Maeve Binchy, the Irish writer, back in 1999. She came out to Yellow Springs with her husband, Gordon Snell, and spent a lovely hour with us here in studio. She was born in 1939 in Dalkey, the oldest of the four children of William and Maureen Binchy. Her siblings included one brother, William Binchy, the Regius Professor of Laws at Trinity College in Dublin, and two sisters, Irene, Reenie, and Joan. Her uncle was the historian D.A. Binchy. Educated at St. Anne's, then located at No. 35 Clarinda Park East, and later at Holy Child Convent in Killeen, she went on to study at University College Dublin, where she earned a bachelor's degree in history. She worked as a teacher of French, Latin, and history at various girls' schools, then a journalist at the Irish Times, and later became a writer of novels, short stories, and dramatic works. In 1968, her mother died of cancer at the age of 57. After her father died in 1971, she sold the family house and moved to a bedsit in Dublin. She hadn't even started writing novels yet. That was still in her future. I'll continue my interview with Maeve Binchy from 1999 right after this.
The Book Nook on WYSO is made possible by 5 local library systems, including the Greene County Public Library and Washington Centerville Public Library.
You are listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. Good morning. I'm Vic McCunis. We have the Best of the Book Nook underway and revisiting a program this morning with Maeve Binchy. I recorded it back in 1999. At the time, she was 60 years old, and she was on her first book tour in the United States. And she never came back on another book tour, so it was really an amazing thing to be able to get her to come out to Yellow Springs for this interview. She died 5 years ago. Her parents were Catholics. Binchy attended a convent school. However, a trip to Israel profoundly affected both her career and her faith. As she confided in a question and answer session with The Vulture, "In 1963, I worked in a Jewish school in Dublin teaching French with an Irish accent to kids, primarily Lithuanians. The parents there gave me a trip to Israel as a present. I had no money. So I went and worked in a kibbutz, plucking chickens, picking oranges. My parents were very nervous. Here I was, going out to the Middle East by myself. I wrote to them regularly, telling them about the kibbutz. My father and mother sent my letters to a newspaper, which published them. So I thought, it's not so hard to be a writer. Just write a letter home. After that, I started writing other travel articles. One Sunday, attempting to locate where the Last Supper is supposed to have occurred, she climbed a mountainside to a cavern guarded by a Brooklyn-born Israeli soldier. She wept with despair. The soldier asked, 'What do you expect, ma'am, a Renaissance table set for 13?
She replied, "Yes, that's just what I did expect." This experience caused her to renounce her Catholic faith, and eventually she became an atheist. That's from her Wikipedia entry. We'll continue now with the best of the Book Nook and Maeve Binchy.
The book's 500 pages, Maeve. How much did you have to have edited out with all these extra characters, et cetera? How long would it have been if they'd printed it in the original?
It would have been 700 pages. So you'd be glad to know that a lot of them are gone. There's a dentist in it called Jimmy Sullivan. And honest to God, I'm ashamed that he's had such a small part now. But I listened to my two wise advisors. I'd given Jimmy lots more things to say in a life of his own, and his wife who worked in the thrift shop and their very difficult daughter and all the rest of it. I'd given loads of story about Jimmy Sullivan. But the editor quite rightly said that if you have a story about every single person on this road, first of all, the book is going to go on forever. It's going to be like the Encyclopedia Britannica. And secondly, we're never going to know who the main characters in it are meant to be, who are really meant to be Marilyn in America and Rhea. I had loads of people also in Marilyn's town. I had loads of other American characters who I had to lose. So I agree with this. I write the whole thing. I don't do any rewriting much, but I write the whole thing, and then I agree, sadly, to a lot of surgery being done on it. And I sometimes fight back a bit and say, can I keep Nora's dog? She had a dog, and I had another
Pliers.
I like the name of the dog. I like the notion. I said, "Please, can I keep Pliers?" And so they said, "All right," because it didn't take up too much space, so Pliers could stay.
And Pliers is a handsome beast. Maeve, the dentist, when I came across his character, I thought to myself, "Gee, he was just in there for a flash, but he seemed like more than a peripheral character." So I guess maybe I had a sense that there was something more there.
Well, thank you, because there's only the bare bones and skeleton of him. He gets to sing at somebody's funeral, and he gets to complain about having to replace Gertie's teeth every time her husband belts her. But that's really about all he's left. He was a fine man before the editors got at him.
I really enjoyed this book, and I'm going to have to backtrack and read some of your other books, because I'm intrigued by the way that you write. You have this incredible narrative flow with Rhea's thoughts looking at things, but the way you shift from different locations to different characters so seamlessly throughout the book, there's so many transitions going on, but they're so smooth. Does this just flow out of you like that?
Well, I suppose it's as if I'm telling a story, and I want to tell you all about my friend Rhea, you know, as if you and I were sitting together on a park bench, and I say, "Let me tell you about my friend Rhea." And she was working in the state agency, and she met this fellow, and everybody warned her about him. You see, I would start to tell a story in that way. And then there might be other things that come in, and so I'd suddenly have to go to them. It's really when it entertains me to move on to the next place that I think it's time to go on to the next place. I'm pleased if you think it's seamless, because I suddenly think, well, now it's time to let them know what's happened to somebody else and how are the children getting on. Because there's a character I'm very pleased with in the book, who is Brian, the young lad, because we have no children, sadly, but we're very friendly with other people's children. We've known lots of little boys that age who always and invariably said the wrong thing and know they have said the wrong thing and then look up and say, "What have I said now?" And there's one of those children in everybody's lives. And, you know, he's a sweet child, because he says always what everybody else is thinking and is afraid to say. So he almost acts in a sense like a Greek chorus. He's moving the story along. And almost every mother feels quite ambivalent about her 14 and 15 year old daughter, and every 14 and 15 year old daughter hates her mother for a bit. So I mean, those are things I know from teaching, so I bring those into them, and I spend a lot of time thinking about the relationship with them, because I could often rule the world, I think, if only people listened to me properly. But I would say to people, believe me, when they're 17 and 18, it'll be all right again. It's just this bit they have to go through of not liking you, and then it'll be fine. It really will be fine. I've been teaching for years in classrooms. I see them go through this snarly bit, and they get over it. It's just nature.
And Annie is the older sister, and in such typical fashion, she and her brother Brian, they don't agree on anything, and there are some very funny little segments where
that rare moment when they actually agree about something, they look at each other like, oh, no, this is horrible. We're agreeing on something. This must really be terrible.
That's right, yes. And they think, you know, the whole situation with it between their parents must be much more dangerous than they think. If they both agree about something, they look at each other in awe. And this has defined the really dangerous level of the whole part of life they're going through more than anything. Because, I mean, you know, when you are young, I mean, I'm hugely friendly with my two sisters and brother now. When I was their age, I could not see one right thing about them. I thought they were obnoxious, their friends were terrible, they were tiresome, and they were wearisome. They thought I was bossy, they thought, you know, all this went on. And we are such close friends now. I often think, if anyone could have seen this, and we went recently, all the whole family, four of us and all our spouses and the children, we went to the Phantom of the Opera one night, and I was just looked around. It was a very nice evening. It was sunset over the Liffey in Dublin, and we were all having a drink together. I just thought what a happy family we were. And if anybody could have seen us, if you could put the clock back to a Saturday night in our house in Dorky, the same place as I live now, as we all live now, years ago, all the dreadful arguments, because we didn't have enough money to heat. We were not poor, it may be said, but we did not have enough money to have a bath every day. So we only had a bath every second or third day. And, you know, there was a dreadful argument about whose term it was to have the bath. And my brother, who is now a professor of law and one of the most sort of admired people in Dublin, I mean, it was his turn to have the bath. And I had to get into the bathroom to get some makeup or something there. I discovered he wasn't having a bath. He was sitting beside the bath, putting his hand in the water, making a noise for a bath. I actually nearly physically murdered him. We'd all have wanted the bath. He'd wasted all that hot water. And I was speechless that night going out to a dance, thinking I could have had that lovely, luxurious bath and I could have lain in that. And instead that awful, oafish brother of mine, you just put his hand in the water and to make a noise to confuse us and let us think he was having a bath. And when I think back on that and to think what a close friendship there is between us all now, I suppose it is wonderful what time does, but we must never forget how the huge hostilities and the inequalities of childhood can make a difference of 3 or 4 years seem like a generation gap that's almighty.
This brother's name isn't Brian, is it?
No, it's not at all. No, I never put a real person in, but I did have Brian not washing much, so perhaps there was a little hint of it there.
Maeve, what's the response been? You're getting a chance to meet your readers here in the United States. What's it been like at these other stores?
Well, it's been very good, but and I would tell you that, wouldn't I? Because I'm not going to say everybody hated me, but the answer is it has been touching for me to go into. I've been to Boston and Chicago, New York, San Francisco, Denver, and now here, and so I'm hoping to meet a lot of readers tonight, and I'll have plenty of time to talk to them. I'm interested in them as well as just what they think of me, and because it's very interesting when you are writing a book. I don't do it just like painting by numbers, but it's lovely to remember a sea of faces of people who are interested in meeting you and who really like the characters. This response has been very good. The publishers say the book is selling very well, which is nice, because after all it's a simple enough story of a place that I know, and it's been bought, my agent says, by about 28 or 30 languages now, and it's hopefully that it's going to be a movie, but let's not ever think about that until the movie comes out. I've always said I'm never going to believe there's going to be a movie until the day I'm actually sitting down with my popcorn at the premiere of it, because there's so many books we're going to be in the past, and apparently 1 in 10 gets through it, you know, when they start. But Circle of Friends was a very nice movie. I was very pleased with that, and it did very well, and it brought me, which was very pleasing, a new young audience, because up to then I used to mainly have older people. When I say older people, people of my own age or younger, because I think I'm only a spring chicken. But my readers were often in their 40s and 50s and above that, until Circle of Friends, when suddenly all the 18-year-olds suddenly they thought, well, if she can write about that sort of thing, which is our life and our loves and our hopes and dreams, maybe we'll see what else she'll read. Actually, Gordon and I once sneaked into the cinema in New York when Circle of Friends was playing, just to hear what the remarks of the audience were. And we saw four kids, all about 18, 19, leaving, saying, let's go down to the bookshop and see what else she's written. And I thought, I wonder, is that an omen? And indeed it was, because my book sales to young people just absolutely rocketed after that. And very often they take the video of Circle of Friends out and look at it together in a group. So I'm hoping very much that there will be a movie of Tara Road, because there's lovely parts for women in it, women in their 30s. There's two Irish parts, or parts could be played by anyone, but of Irish women, who is Rhea and her very glamorous friend Rosemary. And also there's a part, lovely part for an American woman, Marilyn, who is a very strong character. And I think a lot of American women would like to play that part. So I've heard, but I'm not going to get excited about it until it's all finally sealed and delivered.
It must have been excruciatingly delightful to be eavesdropping at that movie.
It was pretty good because they all seemed to like it.
Maeve Benchy has joined us. The book is Tara Road. Do you do much reading just for fun, for pleasure?
Not enough, because I'd love to tell you I worked so hard, but I just seems to take longer to get things done. There's much more people to write to now than there used to be. I try to answer all fans' letters, which is nice, and I write just a scrawly postcard to everybody who writes to me. And then of course there's people in different countries writing now. I have to deal with publishers in Germany or Sweden or other things as well. None of that was there before, so I don't read as much as I used to. But I read an awful lot of thrillers, and I read books that I'm not at all of my own kind of writing. I'd never be able to write one in my life, but I like very much. Say Carl Hyas or Elmore Leonard, or well, I also like Kurt Vonnegut very much, like David Baldacci. I like Douglas Kennedy, who wrote The Big Picture and The Job. These kind of books with excitement and adrenaline pumping in them the whole time. I like those. Wouldn't be able to write one to save my life, but I like those very much. And I like Ruth Rendell and P.D. James. All these things where there's I forget them, which is grand, so I could read another one all over again because I'd forgotten who did it. It's like looking at Inspector Morse on the television. If you get an old Morse that you haven't seen maybe three, four years ago, I totally forgot who was the murderer, so I'll watch through it happily again. But those are books I read for relaxation.
I had P.D. James on this program a while back, and I must say I was in somewhat of a state of awe.
She's an amazing woman, isn't she?
She really is. Well, I'm definitely thrilled and delighted that you could come out here to Yellow Springs and tell us about your book and what you've been doing.
Well, it's been great. I mean, I love talking about myself, and you're very kind enough to encourage me, so I've thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it.
And it's been great meeting your husband as well.
Gordon Snell is a saint, and if he weren't a Protestant and if he weren't alive, he would be canonized, let me tell you that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you too very much, Vic.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. That was the late Maeve Benchy, recorded live in studio here in Yellow Springs, back in 1999. And according to her Wikipedia entry, Benchy, described as 6 feet tall, rather stout and garrulous, although she actually grew to 6'1", confided to Gay Byrne of The Late Late Show that growing up in Dalkey, she never felt herself to be attractive. As a plump girl, I didn't start on an even footing to everyone else. After her mother's death, she expected to lead a life of spinsterhood, or as she expressed, I expected I would live at home, as I always did. She continued, I felt very lonely. The others all had a love waiting for them, and I didn't. She ultimately encountered the love of her life, however, when recording a piece for Woman's Hour in London. She met children's author Gordon Snell, then a freelance producer with the BBC. Their friendship blossomed into a cross-border romance with her in Ireland and him in London, until she eventually secured a job in London through the Irish Times. She and Snell married in 1977, and after living in London for a time, moved to Ireland. They lived together in Dalkey, not far from where she had grown up until Benchy's death. The following was her view of her husband, quoted in the Irish Times, after her death. Quote, a writer, a man I loved, and he loved me, and we got married, and it was great, and it is still great. He believed I could do anything, just as my parents had believed all those years ago. And I started to write fiction, and that took off fine, and he loved Ireland, and the fax was invented, so we writers could live anywhere we liked instead of living in London near publishers. In 2002, Benchy suffered a health crisis related to a heart condition, which inspired her to write her book Heart and Soul. The book about what Benchy terms a heart failure clinic in Dublin and the people involved with it reflects many of her own experiences and observations in the hospital. Towards the end of her life, Binchy had the following message on her official website. "My health isn't so good these days, and I can't travel around to meet the people I used to, but I'm always delighted to hear from readers, even if it takes me a while to reply." She was a special woman, Maeve Binchy. You've been listening to the best of the Book Nook. Check out our Book Nook archive of podcasts at wyso.org. We have over 400 interviews you can listen to anytime you please. For the best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. And thanks for supporting your public radio station.